Welcome to the Ideal Spaces Working Group podcast.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Today we have an interesting podcast with Molly Slavin from the Atlanta University, USA, about cathartic crime. We are Grant Rainham and Ulrich Gehmann from the Ideal Spaces Foundation, and Molly, please start.
Hi, thank you so much for having me here today. My name's Molly Slavin, and I am an assistant professor of English at Clark Atlanta University in Atlanta, Georgia, in the United States. And I'm very excited to be here talking today.
You spoke about cathartic crime at our symposium about the neoliberal agenda we held quite recently at our foundation's seat in southwest of Germany. What do you understand under cathartic crime in today's neoliberal urban circumstances?
Sure. So I coined the term cathartic crime in my first book, which is called Criminal Cities and is out from the University of Virginia Press. My basic argument is that depictions of crime in literature often, and specifically in city literature, very often function as sort of a form of catharsis for both readers and the characters in the literature to process and work through various structural processes in their cities, ranging from neoliberalism, economic inequality, imperial legacies, et cetera. So I argue basically that looking at crime in literature is sort of a way to process the ravages of neoliberalism, imperialism, and other structural harmful policies upon our contemporary space, our contemporary urban spaces.
Okay, can you outline this a bit more, please?
Sure. So in the symposium that I presented at Ideal Spaces, I looked at a few cities in particular, the literature set in a few cities in particular. Specifically, I looked at contemporary London, and I looked at the novel Saturday by Ian McEwan, to basically argue that there's this home break-in that happens in the novel that functions as sort of a larger metaphor for the impending British invasion of Iraq in 2003. And I made the argument that looking at this sort of crystallized crime in the literature provides a way for readers and the characters in the novel to think through the ways in which neoliberalism has sort of taken over from imperialism in specifically the British setting. So it looks at how imperialism has sort of, with the fall of the British Empire, transmuted itself into sort of like Thatcherite economic policies and ideologies, and how that is dividing and fracturing and atomizing individuals in the same way as imperialism used to. And something I did not talk about in the symposium, but that I'd like to sort of delve into a little more here, is specifically looking at how that works in the contemporary city of Dublin and some crime literature set in Dublin by the writer Tana French.
Please go ahead.
Okay. So I would like to talk about the city of Dublin. I'd kind of like to start by thinking about real life Dublin and how neoliberalism works in that city, and then transition into thinking about how crime literature both responds to and helps shape neoliberalism in the city of Dublin and often points to sort of a more promising or more hopeful future. So Dublin, Ireland is the largest city in Ireland. For many, many, many centuries, it was controlled by the British Empire, broke free and became the capital city of the Republic of Ireland in the early 20th century. After the British left, Dublin remained a fairly poor city, in part due to economic policies pursued by post-colonial leaders such as De Valera. But after many, many decades of poverty, in the early 1990s, Ireland and Dublin in particular experienced a boom in prosperity, unlike it had ever seen before, that was called the Celtic Tiger. It was called this because a few short years before, Asian cities such as Singapore and Hong Kong had experienced intense economic prosperity, and those were called the Asian Tigers. So the Celtic Tiger got named after those economic booms. So the Celtic Tiger kind of ripped and roared throughout the 1990s and early 2000s. Ireland, for the first time, experienced in-migration. Ireland and Dublin in particular, had been plagued by years of out-migration to sort of greener economic pastures. For the first time, Ireland experienced people actually moving to Ireland, and the country actually attained pre-potato famine levels of population. So the island had been depopulated since the potato famine of the 1840s. So this was this great economic miracle, but sort of anyone who was paying attention would know that this economic miracle could not last. It was neoliberal in nature. It was very focused on tax cuts, on making the rich richer. It was unsustainable, essentially. And in 2007, 2008, with the worldwide housing crash and global recession, the Celtic Tiger came to an end as well. So after, you know, 20 sort of very heady years of excess, almost like a roaring 20s sort of aesthetic, jobs collapsed. Again, people were migrating out. Housing costs collapsed. You know, kind of the same story that you saw everywhere in 2007, 2008. But it was particularly rough for Ireland and Dublin because they were coming off the sort of unprecedented period of economic prosperity. Ireland sort of gets put on this austerity plan by the European Union, along with Portugal, Greece, and Spain. There was this nasty acronym going around calling those countries the pigs due to their poverty after the 2008 recession. Ireland sort of muddles along for a few years. And now, supposedly, the boom, if you go to Dublin today, there are, building sites again. Those gleaming office towers are going back up. And according to people, the boom is back. But of course, if the boom is back, we should be bracing for another fall, unfortunately, soon as well. But that all aside, I'd like then to sort of turn our attention to crime literature set in Dublin and how it deals with neoliberalism and the Celtic Tiger and the Celtic Tiger's collapse. Specifically, the writer Tana French, who has written a series of books called the Dublin Murder Squad series. So Tana French has 6 books out. Well, she's written more, but 6 books belong to this series, to this Dublin Murder Squad series. These 6 books are explicitly crime novels. And they are each focus on a crime that happens in or around Dublin, murder, because it's the murder squad. And each of these books focuses on sort of a different aspect of neoliberalism and its effects on community, its effects on urban spaces. Each of the novels is narrated by a detective, and then the detective has a sidekick, and then the next novel will be narrated by the sidekick, if that makes sense. So the first novel is narrated by a detective and the sidekick. The second novel is the sidekick and then her new sidekick. The third is that sidekick, and you get the idea. So there's a rotating cast of narrators. As I mentioned, all 6 of the novels focus in some capacity on neoliberalism and what it does to urban spaces. But I'd like to focus specifically on the 1st and 4th books in the series. In the Woods would be the first one, and then Broken Harbor is the second. In the Woods is the first novel in the series, and it's got a bit of a convoluted plot line, but essentially there is a housing estate outside of Dublin that where a body of a young girl has been found. This body is found on the site of an ancient archaeological dig. Students from a local university are working on uncovering objects from ancient Celtic Ireland, and they find the body of this young girl on the dig. This murder investigation and the archaeological dig are complicated because the city of Dublin wants to expand a motorway out to this housing estate. And they claim that the only route for this motorway is right through the archaeological dig. So there's a lot of intrigue going around local activists who want to stop the motorway, people in Dublin who want to expand it. And that's all kind of mapped onto this larger archaeological dig and subsequently the murder investigation, which I will return to in just a moment. Broken Harbor is the fourth book in the series, and it takes place on what is called a ghost estate. So again, a housing estate on the outskirts of Dublin. But a ghost estate is this sort of particular Irish phenomenon where, as I mentioned, during the Celtic Tiger, migration to Ireland was growing. There was a great need for housing. Houses were going up faster and faster and faster than, you know, people could move into them, basically. But in 2008, the funding collapses. And there are all these, and so the Irish countryside, and very specifically sort of the outskirts of Dublin and other large cities, are littered with these half-finished ghost estates that basically just got abandoned. And so there will be these estates of 300 or 400 houses, and maybe 4 or 5 people will actually live in them. It's a very eerie sight to see. So Broken Harbor takes that sort of eerie setting and sets a murder investigation on the site of this housing estate. So those quick summaries of those novels, I just want to illustrate that both are very focused on the effects of neoliberalism and specifically the particular Irish context of the Celtic Tiger. Both novels are set on these far-flung housing estates. Characters often mention how they can't afford to buy in Dublin city center, so it's important they buy these sort of cheaply, quickly constructed houses on the outskirts of town. In the case of In the Woods, there's this focus on the motorway, on this sort of eschewing of public transportation in favor of individualized, you know, motor transport. In Broken Harbor, there's a big emphasis on the family who is discovered in the ghost estate, that everyone except the mother is dead. And there's a big focus on how they've left their tight-knit community in Dublin and moved out here where they know no one, where they have no organic community, simply because it was the only home they could afford in the midst of this sort of hedonistic, neoliberal, Celtic Tiger building extravaganza. And these two novels in particular illustrate it well, but also just generally overall, the series, the Dublin Murder Squad series overall, has this like very obsessive focus on real estate and on urban sprawl in particular, on this idea of housing costs, of building horizontally rather than vertically, on the supposed importance of the single family home instead of dense walkable flats or something that might form some sort of like urban fabric or urban community. And the series works really desperately to prove why this is an unsustainable model, why it will lead to fracturing of community, atomization of individuals, and of course, sort of the reason of the series, violent crime, and specifically murder, because this is, again, a series following the Dublin Murder Squad. So in each novel, the murder is prompted by sort of economic hardship or the class striving of the particular characters. In particular, in Broken Harbor, the young couple who's named Jenny and Pat, and they have 2 children, they move out of, again, this very tight-knit Dublin neighborhood where they've grown up, where all their family is, where all their friends are. Their friends explicitly tell them on several occasions that it is crazy to move to this housing estate. They tell them, you don't know anybody. There's no schools out there. There's not even a grocery store. You know, what are you going to do out there? But Jenny and Pat have this obsessive fixation, and they keep telling them, it's important that we get on the property ladder. We have to get on the property ladder. It becomes almost like a mantra for them. This idea that they have to be able to buy a house so that eventually they can, you know, proceed up and up and up the ladder. This sort of like teleological view of home and of financials. The home is not a place to live. The home is just a way to sort of move up, so to move up socioeconomically, because they'll buy this house and sell it and then buy a bigger house and eventually sell it, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I don't want to give away, you know, I don't want to do spoilers for people who might actually be interested in reading these books. But the crime, the violent murders come out of this obsessive focus on real estate, on single family homes, on upward neoliberal class striving. And of course, I don't want to put too much blame on the individuals, you know, the characters in question, because this is like a structural issue. They've been told it's important to get on the property ladder, and so it becomes their fixation. But the fact remains that it's this sort of neoliberal economic outlook, our nuclear family above everyone else, that leads to this eventual horrific murder, which, again, I will sort of not spill the details on in case people are interested in reading the book themselves.
It's an interesting point in terms of catharsis, of the cathartic crime, and of catharsis in general. In this example of housing, the value of a house, of a home, is meanwhile becoming a part of, let's call it, a myth of progress. A home is not a home. A home is an instrument, as are any other instruments, for achieving more progress in personal terms. It's a new form of catharsis for me, you know?
Yes, very much. It's quite clear. I'm focusing more on Broken Harbor, but this is also true of In the Woods. It's quite clear, this idea that the home is not a home. The home is not a place to raise your children or to see them play, or to get to know your neighbors or form some kind of community. The home is a means to an end. It's something that you will eventually be able to sell down the line. And what I think is, you know, interesting about the way the Dublin Murder Squad treats this in terms of catharsis is it sort of assumes a particular positionality of the reader. And that is that you will, Tana French as a writer seems to assume that most of her readers will essentially agree with her that this is bad, which is something I find interesting because it sets ourselves up for this catharsis. I think there are these prevailing societal grand narratives that the home is not really a home. As you just said, the home is not really a home. The home is instead a means to an end, a way to level up in economic striving. So I think it would be reasonable of her to position her books to sort of convince you otherwise. But she begins from the starting point that she assumes her reader is kind of on her same page, that it's very bad what neoliberalism has done to our cities and to our communities. I think that's interesting for a couple of reasons. First, because it's sort of by assuming the positionality of the reader, it helps the literature then helps to shape reality, not just reflect it. By assuming this is common sense, that neoliberalism is bad, you can kind of fold your reader into your overall argument, but also, as you say, because it sets us up for a really interesting catharsis. All of these novels are, of course, sort of, because they are murder novels, because they're crime novels, are sort of pitched toward a particular teleological end that you are expecting as a reader. You know, you expect the crime to be solved, you expect justice to be served, whatever that means. And they do. Again, I don't want to give away the endings of either of these novels in case people are interested in reading them. But because Tana French has assumed you are in on it since the beginning, the eventual catharsis is more of finding out who did it, of finding out the ending, is almost more satisfying in that way because you've been assumed to be a fellow traveler this whole time. And what that catharsis does, sort of extrapolating out from just the literary study to the quote unquote real world, is ideally it helps the reader see how neoliberalism is working in their own cities, in their own communities. I don't have the numbers to hand, but Tana French's novels have sold extraordinarily well, and they're just frankly aren't that many people in Dublin. So I would assume most of her readership is actually coming from outside Dublin and probably even from outside Ireland. She's sort of this global phenomenon. So even if you don't live in Dublin, what reading these and what reaching that catharsis of here's how the murder is solved and oh my goodness, look at all the structural economic forces that led us there can hopefully attune the reader to seeing how neoliberalism is focusing in their or is working in their own cities, in their own spaces, and hopefully work to change it in some capacity.
Okay. I want to compare, and it came to my mind what you presented in our symposium on the neoliberal agenda, where you presented different cases leading to comparable ends in the end. And one aspect which came to my mind was as regards this this promise of climbing up the social ladder through more achievements in terms of property, of money. You mentioned two other stories where people existed that explicitly and deliberately followed and hoped for this neoliberal, let's call it, myth of progress.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So another aspect of neoliberalism that I think is helpful to kind of think about is this myth of progress, like you say. And specifically, I think neoliberalism asks us, or maybe even forces us, to think of life in sort of a set teleology. This is going to happen, and then this is going to happen, and then this is going to happen. And there is no sort of deviating from that straight line. You know, if you look, if you think about it in very stark neoliberal terms, it's, you know, stock market line goes up, right? It will just keep going up, 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 up. And again, this neoliberal ideology is just going to hold that nothing bad will ever happen. The line will never go down, right? If you're a true neoliberal, this is kind of something you have to believe. Just up, 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 continual progress. That doesn't happen just realistically. You know, if you look at something like the Celtic Tiger or the Asian Tigers or American economics or really any kind of example you can think of. But it also doesn't really work in fictional literary worlds. So as I, you know, said about the Dublin, the Tana French Dublin novels, you know, we believe in the myth of progress until there's a violence, a murder that shatters that reality. And we're forced to realize it was a myth all along. But I can highlight another example from London. So not incredibly geographically far from Dublin, but a very different cultural context. This is a novel I looked at in the paper for the symposium. But there's a 2012 novel by British writer Zadie Smith called NW that focuses on the friendship between two adult women named Leah and Natalie, who have been friends since childhood, but it mostly focuses on their relationship in adulthood. And again, I won't give away too many details for those who might want to read it, but that that novel is sort of also fractured by a crime of murder, a very violent murder as well. But what I think is interesting about NW, whereas the Tana French novels are very forward focused, again, they're crime novels. So a crime happens, the police investigate, there are certain steps they follow, and then the crime is solved. It maps onto that neoliberal notion of teleology very nicely. NW is much, much more fractured. It's told from the perspective of shifting narrators. Some sections are very sort of straightforward teleological realism. Some sections are very fragmented, sort of representing sort of the reality of the neoliberal city that is atomized, difficult to sort of pin down. But what I will focus on here is that there is a scene where the two main characters, Leah and Natalie, are at a dinner party. And the scene is sort of told in dialogue from the dinner party guests. And Leah, who is sort of resistant to neoliberal grand narratives. She doesn't necessarily think of herself as being on the property ladder. She doesn't really have a career trajectory she's following, is listening to Natalie's friends. Natalie is a very sort of upward mobile professional. She's a lawyer. She has goals. She's much more like a good neoliberal subject. And Leah isn't listening to Natalie's friends, who are by and large like Natalie. And they're saying things like, but of course, you know, that's just a starter flat. And you'll sell that flat when it's time for your kids to go to school because they have to go to the best school. Don't you want what's best for your individual child? And they're just sort of continually saying things like this, revealing themselves to believe in this myth of progress. Again, that is focused on the individual. There's no sense of wanting to stay in a community where they might have roots or stay in a community where they could hope to build it from the ground up. There's just this sense of nothing is permanent. Everything is a stopping off point. And as soon as there are greener pastures, they will kind of jump ship to keep progressing up this imaginary ladder.
Yeah, the point is, you outlined it quite good in my eyes. Where this teleology is ending, because in itself, as you outlined it, it has no end. There's always a greener pasture, and I can and the meaning of life is then to be on the move.
Yes,
for ever greener pastures.
There's no point
to come down. There's no point to settle. There's no point to breathe.
It just makes people extremely frantic, right? If there's always something better right around the corner, why stay in this job? Why stay in this community? Why stay in this house? You have to constantly be striving, constantly be working to do better. And that's just an exhausting way to live. And I mean, it's sort of by design, because if you are constantly looking for the better job, constantly looking for the better neighborhood, constantly looking for the better house, the better school system, you don't have time to devote to political projects, right? You can't deeply root yourself in sort of a neighborhood improvement committee. You can't really work on a political campaign. You can't involve yourself in prisoner solidarity efforts, right? You don't have time to do any of that because you are so exhausted reaching for the next step on the ladder.
Can I ask a question relative to economic situation in the United States and in Europe right now? There's a real problem for people existing even as they climb up the ladder. Is the tightness of trying to make a living and pay all these bills adding a really negative element to what's going on in society now?
I would say certainly yes, because again, you're sort of constantly asked to reach for a level just above you, right? I mean, a personal story I'll tell is just that my husband and I bought our first home a couple years ago, and you have to go to a bank and get a loan and stuff. And we were both, when they came back and they said, you know, you are approved for a house up to this value, we were both floored. We thought there is absolutely no way we can afford a house that expensive. Are you crazy? You know, like that would bankrupt us. And our realtors kept pushing us to look for a house on the higher end of our loan approval. And we just kept saying, no, you know, I think we'd really be more comfortable in this area. But it really drove home for me. And we did end up sort of purchasing within our means, but it did really drive home for me the effect that, like, you know, there is an incentive to ask you to buy a house outside your means, because then that's all you can do, right? Instead of getting a comfortable mortgage payment, it is just out of reach, and it is making it, as you say, Grant, much more difficult to survive on the day to day.
Yeah, the progress is not in increasing quality of life or increasing friendships or community bonds. The progress is only for yourself a new kind of neoliberal social Darwinism. Is this correct?
I mean, I think absolutely. Again, you know, to go back to Broken Harbor, or, you know, my person, you know, the characters in Broken Harbor buy this house. It's just for the sake of buying a house. They buy it just so they can have a house. They leave behind their community, their family, their friendship, and they move out to this ghost estate where they are one of like three families living there, for really nothing except the sense that they were getting on the ladder. They were making progress, something that no one really cared about except them, right? And if my husband and I had bought this expensive house, we'd probably have to take on second jobs. We'd never have time to see friends or family or build community because we'd be so obsessed with buying this, with paying for this house that was too expensive for us to begin with.
Mm-hmm. Okay, this is interesting. It looks like a reversion or even a perversion of a kind of, as regards Occidental cultural heritage, of perverted Christian eschatology. The individual will be saved, and the individual will be saved in moving up this endless Jacob's ladder of financial progress in the end, which means progress is delimited to one dimension. And this is related to the hope that I, the individual, will be experience a kind of revelation when I'm moving up in financial terms at the social ladder. But there is no social any longer. There's only a ladder for the individual.
I had never thought of it like that, but that's so interesting. And of course, there's no revelation at the end, right? Because heaven is just always one further step up the ladder. And maybe if you get this better job or move to this bigger house, you'll get there. But then, of course, there's always a bigger house and a better job. That's really interesting. I'd never thought of it like that.
Okay. In your eyes, as regards the phenomenon of catharsis, what are the main points of this cathartic crime today? In your personal point of view, having read these literatures, having experienced in your own life what happened, what you told, crime is one thing, but if the system, at least in social terms, is criminal already, the system dynamics of this neoliberal system, what means catharsis then for the individual also?
So the sort of traditional or classical understanding of catharsis is that it prevents political action. So Aristotle theorized that catharsis is basically, we go to the theater to see a play where, you know, the mob kills the king. And if we experience that sort of dramatic catharsis, then we don't feel like we have to kill the king in real life. The traditional sense of catharsis prevents political action. I want to make the argument that in neoliberal cities, I think literary catharsis or dramatic catharsis, to use Aristotle's words, but in literature, because it is a more novel reading, is a more individual activity, you know, suited for our neoliberal times than going to the theater in a group would have been. Neoliberal literary catharsis actually kind of works in the opposite way. When we see the violent effects of neoliberalism, of this criminal system, as you say, how it must always basically lead to violence in one way or another, we are not stymied from action, but we are instead encouraged to act, right? In this way, I think it's important to study literature because literature, I don't think, reflects reality. I think literature helps to shape it. So I think that's why writers like Tana French or like Zadie Smith are so important, because again, they sort of assume the reader is on their side from the beginning. Being anti-neoliberalism is just common sense, these novels seem to say. I'm not going to convince you of anything. I'm going to assume you are already on my side. And then I'm going to take you through and show you the ravages that this criminal economic policy leads to. And the only conclusion by the end is that, of course, I have to act in some way in the real world, because what I have just seen on the page is so violent and so terrible that I have to prevent it from happening in my own life, in my own community.
Mm-hmm. This is one conclusion. The other conclusion, at least as an alternative, could be that people, let's say, reunite, or even at least consider how we can change these overall living conditions.
Yes, I mean that's very much the hope, right? The idea is that you break out of your sort of individualistic novel reading mode, which is again an inherently sort of atomized activity, and join in a larger community political consciousness. That's very much the hope.
Mm-hmm. Is this hope realistic when you are always confronted with the mythical promise of this endless Jacob's ladder of progress? I don't know the answer.
I don't either. I think I even said at the end of my symposium paper, I'd like to give an alternative here, but of course I'm not an economist. I don't know how to fix the real world criminal economic system. But what I do think is that literature can ask us to imagine something better, imagine a more ideal urban space. So I do hope that, art and literature can help us reach that catharsis to do something productive with it.
That's a good point. And as regards economy, this existing system might not even be changed by economy, but by some other factors. You cannot change a system with the means and the systemics produced by this system, and these are economic systemics. To readdress the whole issue and say, okay, when we are speaking about an assumed human condition in a positive way and a realistic human condition we experience in a neoliberal context now, how to close the gap?
Mm-hmm. I wish I knew.
I mean, either, yeah, but as a moving force, at least, as if people would think about that, or at least some people, becoming more than just some, would think about that. When I look at my existing living conditions, as Grant outlined it, and as you experienced it partly, if this is our real life, how we can change our real life to make it better?
I mean, my answers, I fear will sound simplistic, but I do think that they're helpful. Things like joining in your community, helping build community institutions if they don't already exist. Again, this is sort of an example, like a minor example just from my own life, but we've all heard the phrase, it takes a village to raise a child, but in the neoliberal world we live in, there very often isn't a village. In my neighborhood in Atlanta, Georgia, we've started sort of a parent child care collective. It's free, it's just sort of on a swap basis, but there is this attempt to recapture the village that neoliberalism has stolen from us. I think that building these sort of community level institutions, and it doesn't, have to be something like childcare, something like, even just like a book club or a monthly dinner potluck, something like that, something small can be sort of the building blocks to mend the ravages of neoliberalism and recapture a sense of community. Of course, those are small examples and it has to work at scale, but I think something like that might be a good start.
Mm-hmm. So therefore, what's neoliberalism, in your view, way it's progressed, hoping for?
Brent, your tone is very, very interrupted.
Oh, I'm just asking, is it if the neoliberal agenda today is a utopian form?
I think it would think of itself as being such, right? I think hardcore neoliberals would say, you know, we have, if we follow the precepts of neoliberalism, we will achieve a utopia. But of course, I mean, utopia literally means like no place, right? It is a place that cannot exist. So I think in sort of common parlance, yes, neoliberals would imagine themselves as wanting to create a utopian space. But in real life, the whole point of utopia is that it's fictional. It can't be achieved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the utopian point is a very, in my eyes, it's a very interesting directive, because it is an utopia, also in the sense of this endless progress means. It is an utopian venture, the whole thing, and it rests on premises and basic assumptions about the human condition, or classically about the conditio humana, that are utopian by themselves. We are not single, isolated individuals tempted to progress, and we cannot progress by ourselves alone, with no respect of our immediate neighborhoods. Even if these neighborhoods are only formal ones, in jobs, in and so on. It's the utopia of the liberated individual, and this I meant with this perverted Christian eschatology. The individual is saved in materialistic terms. This is the utopian promise in the end of this neoliberal agenda. Help yourself and then you will be saved. If there would be an end, and if there would be the final greenest pasture you can arrive at.
Right. And that's the key point, right? That you have to help yourself. Like, the whole point of neoliberalism is that you have to be the driver, right? No one is going to help you. It's all up to you.
Yeah.
Which is, again, just an exhausting way to live.
Yeah, this is, and it's impossible. This is the utopian point. Even a hardcore individual driver needs some people to repair his car for him.
Yes.
He is not alone and independent. No?
Yes, yes.
Okay. What could be, in your eyes, what could be a kind of fazit as regards your topic, in your eyes? What are the most important points to consider?
I suppose to sum up, just from sort of, again, my work as a literary scholar, I think what I'd like to leave people with is just, we tend to see, there's sort of a prevailing narrative that crime in literature serves sort of like a silly purpose. Crime novels are just things you take to the beach or that you read on airplanes, and they're very disposable. But I'd like to ask listeners to take crime in literature very seriously as you read, to be attentive to how crime is pointing out the ravages of neoliberalism, asking you to think about how to apply these lessons about these harmful structures to your own world, to prevent the sort of crime that you see in the novels from happening in your own community. Basically, I'd just like to, you know, tell people this is far from being a silly genre. It's actually a very important politically minded genre with something to say to you about neoliberalism, community, and public good over private property, I suppose.
Well, that's a very good conclusion. Okay. Many thanks, Molly, for this podcast.
Great. Thank you so much.
We have to thank you, Molly.
Yeah, thank you very much, Molly.
Thank you. Many thanks.